you want to talk about race. Kind of? Sort of? God, no. Anything but that. For years, Ijeoma Oluo has been prompting conversations about race, and now she has a book about it, too. It's called So You Want to Talk About Race. Ijeoma is a racial justice advocate, she's editor at The Establishment, and she is an author. So You Want to Talk About Race is her how-to guide, and it's published by Seal Press. Ijeoma, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, who is this book for?
I'm really glad you asked, first of all, because I think a lot of people make assumptions about who this book is for. This book is honestly for anyone who has a genuine intention of doing better in conversations about race. So really, that's the only requirement. There are certain parts of the book that are kind of geared towards people in different demographics. But really, if you just want to have a better chance of success in these conversations, this book is for you.
You are interested in talking to white people about race, but you're not necessarily interested in speaking to your garden variety Klansmen. Why not?
I think it's been really interesting to watch how people kind of skip over the everyday American well-meaning person who may just not quite get it when we talk about race. A lot of conversation is, how can I make this virulent racist love people of color? But the truth is if we want to make progress, there's a vast majority of people in this country who think they're doing really well or would like to do really well, but maybe just don't have the tools. Mm-hmm. I'd like to start there, where we have a better chance of success and really making progress, than going all the way to the extreme and saying, let's get this small minority of the population to suddenly love us.
And one thing you note early on in the book is that the extreme, as you say, the unmitigated racist, doesn't even have that much power. How is that?
I think it's important to realize that race is a system, right? Racism and racial oppression is a system in this country. So it's really about how engaged you are with the system. So a lot of times the people that we see who are kind of like these outcasts running around shouting racial slurs, they're not actually really a part of a lot of these everyday systems, whether it be our voting systems, our employment systems, and our government, things like this. It doesn't mean that we don't have racism in these systems and in people in these systems. But really, it's really the people who are kind of maybe afraid to say what they really think about race, who might out of politeness hold back some of their biases, who are the people who really do have the most power to make change. And those are the people I really want to reach out to.
And these are people who clearly you think are interested in having this conversation to some degree.
Yes, I think either it's people who are interested in this conversation or who have come to the realization that even if they aren't, it's something they can't avoid.
So are there certain kinds of classic mistakes that you think that person makes?
Definitely. I would say the number one mistake that people make when they enter conversations about race is they aren't clear about their intentions to themselves or to the person they're talking to. So people get in this conversation and they're like, oh, here's what I think. And I hear it all the time. People walk up to me, they know I write about race, and they just start talking. But they don't really know what they want to accomplish
in
the conversation.
At you.
Yes. And they don't know what they want to accomplish. I don't know what they want to accomplish. So I don't even know what conversation I've agreed to enter into. A lot of times by stopping and thinking, wait, why do I want to talk about this? Is it because I want to understand more? Is it because I want to be better understood? Is it because I want to find out if there's a problem in this situation and how to solve it? Finding that, knowing it for yourself and stating it, it gets rid of about half of the major problems we have in these conversations.
You open up early on with your own story. Tell us where you grew up.
I grew up in Seattle, Washington, which is a very progressive city. It's also a very white city. It's one of the whitest major cities in the country. I was raised by a white mother. My father is Nigerian, and he went to Nigeria when I was young and died there. And so I was raised in kind of this white area where race surrounded me because my brother and I were the only people of color everywhere we went. So it was this thing that was very obvious, and we were very obviously treated differently. But being a progressive city, no one would ever talk about it. So I grew up with this frustration of knowing there was a reason why I was being treated differently, looked at differently, but no one would say why.
So what is this that you're getting at with a progressive city that's unwilling to go there? This is something we hear a lot about cities like Seattle or Portland, that they're progressive and yet. And I'm trying to understand that dynamic. Why is it that progressive cities have this particular problem?
You know, I think I liken it a lot to when you watch like movies where they talk about the Old South, right? And you have the virulent racists and people watch that and go, I would have been the person telling him what's what. But you aren't in that situation, so you don't get to test it. And a lot of these areas where a lot of people have very limited contact with people of color, they can imagine themselves as the most progressive and the most anti-racist, but it doesn't get tested. And so then there becomes a discomfort, because when you're suddenly face-to-face with people of color, you don't actually have any practice with how to talk to someone and relate to someone and have these discussions. So silence. And, you know, maintaining that comfort and that veneer that I would still be the right person, I would still be the hero in this situation, becomes the number one priority, instead of trying to figure out where you really are and who you really are in these conversations.
So you and your brother growing up in Seattle, there's very few people of color around you. You feel that. At what point do you start, I guess, are you able to articulate that to yourself, that this is what's going on?
I was incredibly fortunate in that my mom was in some ways grieving my father and worked very hard to try to keep us connected to our roots and who we are, to Nigerian culture and to Black culture. So it was very helpful to know, at least at home, there was a little bit of context put. So if we were followed around the store and we didn't understand why, my mom was not afraid to say, you know, unfortunately, because you're Black, some people are going to do this. It doesn't mean every time that's why, but it's going to be more likely, and try to put that in context to, with us. It was strange to have this environment where that was recognized and then nowhere else it was. For me, because I was kind of an outsider, and my brother was as well, you become very observant. We didn't have a lot of friends. You know, and we were always kind of on the outside of everywhere we were. So we spent a lot of time just trying to fill in the blanks. And then, of course, through education, through books, I started reading and wondering, you know, what is the reason why this is working the way it is? And, you know, when you spend a lot of time observing, you can really fill a lot of that in.
In terms of how the two of you were treated differently, you write quite movingly about how your brother became very isolated in ways that were really the fault of the classroom, the teacher, and the school system.
Yes. And honestly, that's probably the one chapter I realized I can't like read in public. I still get very upset about it, because he's my little brother. Yeah. And I love him dearly. But I think a lot of people don't understand, and I think my brother's case shows how it has a very strong mental and physical impact on people of color to be so isolated and to be so gaslit by society, to be treated differently and have no one acknowledge why. And my brother, who was treated incredibly unfairly by the school system, and then, you know, no one actually saying this is why, it had a really measurable impact on him growing up. And it's only through his immense strength and quite a bit of luck that he was able to pull himself out of an abyss that kind of placed him in. But a lot of children of color, and especially a lot of young Black men, are never able to do so. But also Black women, we're seeing now the health toll it's taking on Black women with rising, mortality rates during pregnancy and after childbirth. They're attributing a lot of that to the everyday stress of living as a person of color in this country.
So the word racist, racism, these are words that are thrown around quite a bit, including by progressives who are trying to shape these conversations. In the book, how exactly do you define racism?
So I define racism as a racial bias backed by a system of power. And I choose to do so because when we talk about this, the reason why I have these conversations is to find solutions. And if you want to find effective solutions to racial oppression, which is really how racism functions in our day-to-day life, then you have to also look at systems. And that means we have to be able to differentiate between racial bias that isn't backed by a system of power and racial bias that is. It's not necessarily saying that one is more benevolent than the other or one is nicer than the other. But, you know, just like when you're diagnosing a disease, you have to figure out what type of cancer this is before you treat it. So when we're looking at systems, if we want to treat a system, then we have to also look at how the system backs up our own biases and turns it into an entire structure that determines a lot of the well-being for people of color in this country.
A lot of these things are known by a lot of people, but there's a certain kind of ephemeral quality to some of these things that people don't know how to put their finger on it. I'm just wondering, when you're talking about all this, do people think of you as preachy or as a scold?
Rarely. I mean, occasionally. And I think sometimes people, it's very easy, I think, when you hear yourself in someone else talking about these issues, especially if it echoes maybe something you might have done in your life, it's very easy to dismiss and say, oh, you're talking to me. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, I'm this person, I've done these
personally.
Things. Yes. And then it's very easy to feel like you're being scolded or lectured to. But I find often, because my role, as I see it, is to show people how this relates to their day-to-day life, that I get a lot less of that than some people do. I'm not necessarily interested in turning everyone into a race scholar so that you can go win your debates. I'm interested in improving your interpersonal relationships, but also in teaching you how to find in your day-to-day life, not necessarily where you've gone wrong so that you can feel bad, but where you've gone wrong so that you can figure out where you can go right. And that's really what I'm looking for. And so I try to keep that conversation really on a practical day-to-day level.
So give me an example of the kind of thing that you feel people can really, like a tool that people can sort of take away from this book or this conversation. What is the kind of thing that you hear people making a common mistake that they can simply tweak a little to have a more productive conversation with someone?
One thing I find often is that when someone will say something like, hey, check your privilege, or you're being very privileged in this mm-hmm. conversation, or your privilege is talking, mm-hmm. people immediately shut down. Partially that's because I think privilege is a concept a lot of people don't fully understand, and they don't understand the intent of being told to check their privilege. One easy way to kind of shift this conversation is the moment you hear someone bringing up your privilege to pause and think, they're telling me that there's a part of this picture that I'm not seeing. The thing about privilege is it sets our life and our advantages as normal. That's our default. And we think that's the same for everyone else. So when someone says, check your privilege, what they're saying is, what you are thinking is normal is stopping you from seeing what my normal is. And it's stopping you from seeing what my reality is. So please pause and consider the fact that you might be missing part of the picture. Look for that as an opportunity, because usually privilege is where you have power. And so if you've been going about your day having access to certain rooms or certain people or opportunities that other people don't, and your privilege is stopping you from seeing that you don't have that, other people do not have that, that means you're in a room to make a difference. You have access to people to say, why aren't these people allowed in? How come these opportunities aren't universal? So look at that as an opportunity to find out something about yourself and your life experience and someone else's life experience that you didn't know before.
When we talk about privilege, there's a couple that come up a lot, white privilege, male privilege, but then you can go down this very long list, and that can, I mean, we're talking about ableism and many other kinds of things. That can be overwhelming and sort of paralyzing for some people to try to take on this huge list of different forms of privilege. How do you get around that problem?
I think a lot of people feel like that. They're like, I could go on forever, and then what do? I just feel bad. I just sit there and feel like maybe I'm this monster who's sucking up all of the privilege. But I actually see it as a great opportunity, because everywhere that I have privilege in my day, I have an opportunity to make change. So as a college, educated woman who has a lot of access to spaces, people will listen to me differently. And that means I better speak up and be careful about what I say. As an able-bodied woman who can walk up a flight of stairs to my favorite restaurant, someone who's in a wheelchair can't get up there to complain and say, excuse me, how come you don't have access? But I can. A lot of times when we look at these systems, we say it's too big, I can't do anything, it's too much, nothing's ever going to change it. But when we actually look at our privilege, what we'll find are hundreds of different opportunities to really make a difference. And that's why we have that conversation. If I'm a stay-at-home mom who has access to my PTA, I have a ton of power to talk about how things are done in my school, whereas, a lot of other parents of color are less likely to be able to show up at a 9 a.m. PTA meeting, right? That's where my privilege is, to show up and raise these issues and say, hey, how come we're not making this more accessible, right? That's where you can empower yourself to really make a difference.
I'm Arun Vanagopal. I'm speaking with Ijeoma Oluo, editor-at-large for The Establishment, about her book, So You Want to Talk About Race. Later on in the show, former professional poker player and author Annie Duke talks about the psychology of making smart decisions under high pressure, plus Neil Mukherjee with his new novel about contemporary India called A State of Freedom. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. In your book, you write, quote, you will get more because they exist to get less. You say this is the enduring promise that sustains racism. What does it mean?
I think a lot of people don't understand that race, as it is defined, was really developed to uphold an economic system built to exploit certain people for the advantage of others. And in order to get people to buy in, everyday people who may not benefit as much, like I would say, you know, your average, like poor, lower class, middle class white American thinks they probably don't benefit that much from white supremacy. But that promise is there. That there are other people who are going to do the hard work, who are going to do the labor, and you will benefit. And that is what has built and sustained white supremacy. And for people at the very top, it's incredibly true. They do benefit a lot from the exploitation of labor of a lot of people. And race happens to be one of the classifications that makes it very easy for people to do that. And a lot of people who have bought into that consciously or subconsciously find it very hard to give up. And a lot of that conversation of people of color are going to take what I have lies in that promise that they don't realize they've been given and that they've accepted.
I just wanted to note something a listener brings to our attention. A lot of white people have the privilege of ignorance when they hail a cab and are quickly picked up and never think that such a thing might not happen so swiftly for people of color. Is that something that rings true for you?
Yes. That's one of the things that is required for a system of white supremacy to function. I don't believe we have people who genuinely want to benefit at the expense of others. And so in order to have a system where that happens, it requires that you be unaware of how it works. And so it's very easy to go about your day. And a lot of privilege works this way, not realizing that your every day is not someone else's every day. If everyone was aware, if white people were aware every day of all of the ways in which things that are easy for them are not easy for people of color, they would be outraged. And they would be outraged at the people who uphold that system, and the system would fall apart. So a lot of what we do as a society to make white normal in our film, in our history books, in all of our culture, in our government, in the way our systems are set up, is partially to make sure that people are not aware that there is a different reality, and so that they cannot get sufficiently outraged, and so they cannot ask the right questions. So a lot of the work we have to do starts first with breaking down that ignorance that has been manufactured to keep you from acting.
I'm wondering about certain sort of stock phrases in the racial discourse, that whether you find a phrase like when somebody says, what about black on black crime, as sort of maybe a dodge around the issue of police violence that's directed at communities of color. Is that a person you can have a conversation with? And if so, how?
Sometimes, rarely. I think it's so well known right now that that's kind of a dog whistle, that to say it, usually, especially to a person of color, you kind of get stuck. But it's a very common thing to say. A lot of times what I try and ask people is, when's the last time you heard someone talk about white on white crime? Because the majority of crime against white people is perpetrated by other white people. But we don't have that term, white on white crime. It's just called crime, right? And people don't want to look further, right? They want to say there's a problem in this community. The problem must be the community. But if you say black on black crime, but you don't say white on white crime, you're saying there's something different about black people and crime that's committed in black communities. You're saying there's something inherently criminal about those communities. But people don't want to just come out and say that, so they come up with this term. I really do want people to better investigate what they're saying when they just spout these phrases and realize why these phrases were developed, and yet they're not universal.
It's also a great way to say, like, get your own house in order before you start complaining about the system or what have you.
Yes. And that's always interesting, too, because it treats it as if black communities exist outside of the system, right? Yeah, we can definitely talk about crime in minority communities, but that also exists as part of a white supremacist system, because then you're going to need to look at poverty in these communities, lack of infrastructure in these communities, lack of jobs in these communities, lack of trust and lack of a healthy relationship with police in these communities. And all of that, once again, comes back to our discussions on race and white supremacy. So getting your own house in order means getting the entire system in order. Nobody wants a solution to crime in inner city communities and minority communities more than the people in those communities who are impacted by it. But it is very hard to call the police when you can't trust them to not shoot an innocent bystander. It's very hard to rise yourself out of poverty when having a black sounding name means that you're four times less likely to even be called for a job interview, or when there aren't even buses that would get you to your job on time, right? Looking at all of these things and how they're interrelated, yeah, we need to look at the whole system. But you cannot expect black people to fix the entire system that's been imposed upon them and has a lot of these horrible side effects, like increased crime in poor communities, which is a universal kind of wherever you go, regardless of race, and say, fix that first.
So why is it that people can see one viral video after another that shows what seems to be a very clear set of facts and still have this kind of a doubt or be unwilling to understand or accept that the problem of people dying in communities of color at the hands of police is a genuine problem? What is really going on there?
I think there's a couple of things that are really going on there. One is a lot of white culture was raised to, you know, revere police. They are the people who protect you. They are members of your community. And I think that it is very hard to reconcile that the same officers that you would trust, that you would run to in trouble, would be the same officers who would immediately see a young black man as a threat and shoot him when he's reaching for his wallet. It's very hard for people to understand that that could come from their community, because then what does it say about them? It's important there to know your history and understand that we actually have a system that was built by design to protect and serve white people and to control people of color. And so you can be both. You can walk through your day and not even know that you consider white people the people you serve and that you consider black people threats. And you don't know that until your instincts take over in a moment of tension. And a lot of people don't want to understand what that means about them and their communities. And so I understand it goes against everything that a lot of white people have been told about police, the people who are assigned to protect them, and a lot of what their lived experience with police is, to understand that those same people could be treating another segment of the population completely differently. And then they wonder, well, how could this? This is my friend. This is my neighbor. What does that mean about me? So I get that. But it's something that we actually do have to delve into, because within that lies a lot of truths about us. Police are just an armed wing of white supremacy. They are not separate from the system. And all of the biases that live within them live within a lot of people in this country. It's just that we aren't armed with guns and put in high stress situations where that biases can turn deadly, but it is deadly in many other ways as well.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and I'm speaking with Ijeoma Oluo, editor-at-large for The Establishment, about her book, So You Want to Talk About Race. When we talk about, say, policing versus, say, something like representation, when people see the conversation about or hear the conversation about roles, acting roles, and some of them, oh no, more of them are being taken, say, by people of color, or that's how they interpret it. When it comes to better policing, that's not necessarily a zero-sum issue, or is it?
I think it's really important to realize how interrelated these issues are, right? So we can definitely, first off, focus on multiple things. So it is always frustrating when you're talking about one issue and someone's like, but what about this? Don't you have bigger problems? And we want to act as if we can only do one at a time, or like they don't relate to each other. The truth is that when we have 12-year-old black boys being shot for playing with toy guns, a lot of that does have to do with representation. If every film you go to and the children worth saving, the children worth bonding with, the children that you see as children are not black children, how do you see black children when you encounter them in the street? Those are our babies, right? Black people, we see them as our babies. But there's really nothing else in our culture that says they are our babies. They're usually just painted as young thugs. So representation definitely matters. Mm-hmm. And when we're telling our young black people what they can be and who they can be, the power of imagination. So many people talk about, I saw this film and I knew that I could be this, or I saw this documentary, or I read in this book. But how few children of color get to see themselves as more in that? And how few of their white classmates get to see their classmates as more than that? We have to look at all of this, because representation definitely supports these systems, justifies these systems. I know people who have never spent any extended time with a black person, but they will still tell me that when they see a young black man walking with sagging pants, they know he's up to no good. Where are they learning that? If they've never had any sort of negative encounter with young black men, they're learning it from representation. Well, our police also learn very similar things from representation. And when we vote for, you know, governments that regulate police, we also are informed by that representation. When we talk about things like getting tough on crime and stop and frisk, a lot of that has nothing to do with our own personal interactions with people of color, and more to the fears that are implanted on us by this misrepresentation.
I'm going to read a couple comments from people who are tweeting at us. Michael from Brooklyn would like for you to discuss the way white folks like him don't understand the oppression around them. And until they do, they won't see the way their political choices can matter. Another man from originally from Jamaica says he never saw people as white or black. They were just Jamaican. He so appreciates her viewpoint, your viewpoint, and says that until people see others not as, quote, racist and different, but just humans, change won't come. So how do people of color empower themselves?
I would say we can empower ourselves and each other, first of all, by recognizing that our lived experience is real and it deserves to be heard. A lot of times we go through our day and things happen to us and we know it's wrong and it hurts and people tell us it's not happening. And, you know, if you go in and someone makes a racist joke and everyone in the room is laughing and you're the only one who isn't, you're being told that there's nothing wrong with that. And so we can empower ourselves and each other first off by saying, what is happening to you is real. You're not crazy. You're not imagining it. And then also supporting each other and holding space for each other for grief and for effort and for relaxation and building a safe space to just be human beings for a while. I think we would all love a break from race. For people of color, we don't usually get to decide when that happens. You know, you walk down the street and you're feeling fine, you're not thinking about race. And then someone says something at you, or, you know, a lady clutches her purse a little tightly as you walk by, and then suddenly there it is. So I think it's important to realize that that's real and it has an impact. And as people of color, we can hold space for each other to try and heal and, you know, recoup from that as we work together to push forward and insulate each other and fight for each other.
Regarding the president, do you think that he was elected because he manipulated people's fears based on race and promising the people that they would get what's, quote, rightfully theirs?
Yes, definitely. I would say, you know, Ava DuVernay did a very good job in painting this as well. This was definitely just a rebirth of the Southern strategy, right? This was a whole, not even dog whistling campaign, because it was very, very blatant of, hey, you aren't happy, things haven't been going well. Well, you've had a black president and everyone's talking about Black Lives Matter. Maybe these black people are taking all of the things that you should have had. Let's take it back to the old days, even though people seem to forget the old days weren't that great for anyone, for them as well. It's a very easy scapegoat, right? Race always has been, and that it was invented to be one, right? It was really invented to say, to be able to exploit and say, no, there's the problem. It's over there. Don't look up here at the 2% of the people who are holding, you know, all of the resources and really, you know, benefiting from the way things are. So yes, I think we are definitely looking at this, but also I think we're seeing a backlash of people who are used to seeing themselves as the norm and as the central focus in this country, right? And for all of this country's history, our leaders have been white men. And what people have aspired to be has always been white men. And every, you know, white male child was told you could be president one day. Very few black children were told you could be president one day. In fact, when Obama was elected, my brother called me sobbing and said, I could have been president and no one told me. And that shift of realizing maybe it's not you, maybe it's not always going to look like you, I think that shook a lot of people up. And to suddenly see then how, even if it didn't change a lot, you know, politics-wise, I mean, let's face it, Obama was not an incredibly far-left president. He was fairly centrist. Mm-hmm. It did change a lot of the way that we talked about race, and people did feel more empowered to say, wait a minute, we matter. And not only do we matter because we have a black president, but we matter because we are human beings worthy of dignity. And people were suddenly saying, wait a minute, how come I'm not the American dream anymore? How come I'm not the focus anymore? How come I'm not the leader anymore? And it really hit people in uncomfortable places they didn't want to talk about. And Trump showed up and said, hey, I'll talk about it. Not only will I talk about it, but I'm going to absolve you of any guilt from being angry about this. In fact, I'm gonna give you permission to be angry at the people of color who have made you feel uncomfortable. Instead of feeling guilty because you're uncomfortable with a black president and uncomfortable with Black Lives Matter, I'm gonna put you on the offensive so that you can say it's their problem and it wouldn't be an issue if they had never brought it up. Let's put it back to where it was rude to say the Black Lives Matter and it was rude to talk about issues of race so that you can go back to being comfortable. And that's really what he offered, and a lot of people signed up.
Has your day-to-day life changed because of the attitude, do you think?
Yes.
How so?
It has. I mean, not as drastically, I think, as a lot of people thought it would. Mm. I think a lot of people of color, we knew this was the reality. It wasn't as if Trump suddenly manufactured racism and suddenly turned people into virulent racists or turned people into people willing to be okay with people walking around with Nazi armbands, you know. We knew the reality of this world. We lived it every day. But it has definitely empowered people to be a lot more open about it. I definitely get a lot more threats than I ever did. I get a lot more slurs hurled at me than I ever did. I see a lot more people being willing to talk in open in office spaces even about, you know, well, how come we can't say white pride?
Really?
Do these things? Because we have a president who says these things, you know, openly. And so why not? And that does scare me, not necessarily because of the impact it has on adults, but because of the impact it has on young adults. The day after the election, I was asking my son if he had heard anything in his high school, my teenager, and he said, well, not from the other students, but one mom did shout at a girl in a hijab that she needed to leave the country. And for young people to see adults normalizing that behavior does recreate a cycle. It does increase the amount of racism in our society because these are people that kids look up to. And that's really where I feel like we have a lot of potential for real harm that really does concern me.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and I've been speaking with Ijeoma Oluo, editor-at-large for The Establishment, about her book, So You Want to Talk About Race. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, former professional poker player and author Annie Duke talks about the psychology of making smart decisions under high pressure. And later, we take your calls about the last time you moved and how that changed your life. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break.